The star atop the Kremlin in Moscow quintuples the spire it crowns. It is not simply flat. Radit has a body with an inner life. Its red is dark and warm, and inside it moves like the slow beating heart of a giant. The strips of gold-tinted lead that connect the glass segments resemble a network of arteries and heighten the impression of a living organ. The young woman and her two small daughters arrived early today at one of the 8 train stations in the gigantic city. They're making a stopover on an adventurous journey. Coming from Kursk, a provincial capital in the south, tomorrow they will board a train at another station, the Belarusian one, heading abroad. In distant Vienna, a man awaits his family impatiently. It is not easy for Nina to leave her homeland, but the unbearable homesickness will only set in later. Now she is full of expectations and joy. Not everyone has the privilege to see Moscow at least once in their life, the heart of the country, the capital of the glorious Soviet Union which defeated fascism. Time, and again, the size, the splendor, the pride of the city takes her breath away. Here, everything is more colorful than at home, cleaner. The passers-by walk with their heads held high and know precisely where they are rushing to. Nina stands there, insecure, pressed against a house wall, lets the endless stream of metropolitans flow by and wander, firmly gripping the shoulders of her children. Just never let loose of the girls. They would be lost here forever. By chance, they have arrived at the wall of the Kremlin exactly when the horse tower bells slowly and solemnly ring out the melody engraved into every Soviet citizen's mind as it heralds the midday hour each day on the radio. The authorities had accommodated Nina in one of the best hotels in the center. In the capitalist outlands, she should rave about how great Moscow is and how commendably the state attends to its people. The 3-year-old is long since asleep from exhaustion. The older daughter cannot be pried away from the window. From this upper story, she has a direct view of the Kremlin with its little houses and towers and churches, also carelessly arranged, as if a child had played with building blocks. She counts a total of 5 of these billowing stars, like the fingers on her hand, like her own years of life. She discovers that they glow even more mysteriously in the dark, and her eyes just can't get enough. In Vienna, no friendly red stars float above the rooftops. The city is forbidding, winter gray and cold. The parents, who cannot really get settled there, search for traces of their homeland, their youth, their culture. One goes to the house of the Austrian Soviet Society on Brahmsplatz, where films are screened in original version, and Ukrainian singer or a Georgian choir performs on stage. On holidays, one meets with friends at the memorial in honor of the Soviet army on Schwarzenbergplatz. The Viennese call it the Russian monument. In winter, the stalwart Red Army soldier with his flag dominates the square. In summer, the Hochstrahlbrunnen fountain makes every effort to veil the memorial behind its high spouts and fine mist, and in the evening, it fascinates with its vivid play of colors in the water, conjured by strong spotlights. Every now and then, there was a call to rid the city of this Russian memorial monument eyesore, but there is a clause in the stake treaty that prohibits it. It should remain standing as a mark that the liberators of the city left on it. The eyes of children climb all the way to the top and all the way to the bottom before settling on a middle zone, on the adult, real world, the world of trade and negotiation, of handshakes, handlings, and handovers. the child perceives the world of the tiniest creeping creatures under its toes, just like that of the flying, sitting, standing figures up there, in their glory and menace. The stone or metal figures are frozen in a pose that also tells of their movements a moment just beforehand and afterwards. Sympathy sets in for the bugs, which are so easy to step on, and for the beings up there who must patiently endure the wind and rain and bird shit for years, decades, centuries. The weather has left its traces on many a face, as if black tears were streaming from empty eyes. A woman tenderly bends down over the child in her arms, but her face is missing. Did a storm carry it away? Sometimes the grandmother would go to the inner city, to the Meinl am Graben store. Only there could you get Knackwurst that meets her standards. In intestine and without flour. The girl stops in awe in front of the portal. Four women support a heavy balcony. Their torsos are naked, their hips loosely wrapped in stone clothes. But what about their legs? Are they walled into the building? Or perhaps they don't have any. All of a sudden, the girl is overcome with physical anxiety. She starts to hop around to ensure the presence of her own limbs until the grandmother hastily moves on with a, "Do you have to pee again?" As they leave the store, the child takes another close look and the trepidation sets in once again. Back at home, she persuades her little sister to play a new game. Try to walk with your feet tied together. The soldier in bronze, the ladies without legs, the countless figures that persevere on high pedestals and facades or sit atop the shoulders of buildings. Perhaps, thinks the child seeking solace, they're having a conversation in their own language, high above the heads of all the people. The verse of a Russian chanson goes as follows. Their shadows were swaying in the doorway. They quietly conversed without saying a word. Like gods, they were beautiful, adoring. Like people, they were wistful and disturbed. Those up there don't feel any sympathy or sadness. They may be beautiful and proud and speak of wisdom, of won or lost battles, of passions and virtues, of coronations and state treaties, of powerlessness and power, of power that no longer destroys because it is petrified in stone. After all, destruction is still undertaken by the wistful people down on earth.